This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, Happy New Year. 2015, another year is over and a new one begins. The year is beginning with a few certainties. More Americans are gaining health coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Activity on the state and federal exchanges has been brisk during the second round of open enrollment, and millions of Americans have either renewed their policies, gained new coverage, or qualified for expanded Medicaid. That's a good news story.
It is, and boy, what a far cry from the tumultuous start we had in the beginning of 2014, Mark, when the federal and most of the state insurance exchanges just were plagued by myriad problems. Those problems, we remember, led to the resignation of HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius in 2014, and so many challenges for the White House over these botched websites and dissatisfied customers.
The systems have been recalibrated and are doing what they are supposed to do, and the new HHS Secretary Sylvia Matthews Burwell is hoping for another 9.1 million Americans to join the 10 million Americans who gained some kind of coverage last year. It's encouraging to see so many uninsured Americans find their way to coverage, as well as preventative health care, which is the ultimate goal of the ACA.
Well, as the new year rings in, there are some changes that we'll see coming in 2015, Mark. The funding for the popular CHIP program, which provides health coverage for about 40% of the nation's children, is due to run out in fiscal 2015. And while most of these children will qualify for coverage under the Affordable Care Act, they might not get the same comprehensive and preventive care that CHIP provides for. So that program needs to be refunded by Congress if it is to continue, and we hope it will be, though we know that could be challenging with the current political scenario in Congress.
You know, it's so vital that there be a program in place to protect the health of the nation's children. We've seen how valuable this program has been for so many of our patients over the years. Some experts fear that relying solely on the insurance exchange plans, some of which have very high deductibles, would put many children at risk for reduced coverage. And many of these plans simply don't cover some serious congenital and other conditions that affect children.
And we're looking at some uncertainty in 2015, Mark. The Supreme Court is set to hear King versus Burwell on March 4th, a legal challenge to the federal subsidies that offset the cost of purchasing insurance for millions of Americans.
I still don't understand how we're this far into it and we're having these significant and serious cases being raised. This one centers around the simple language in the law that states that subsidies are only available to those Americans who purchase insurance through state-based exchanges. Only 16 states opted to set up insurance exchanges. The rest of the states rely on the federal exchange for coverage. If the court rules in favor of the literal interpretation of the language, it could threaten the basis for providing tax subsidies for those who qualify.
The decision expected sometime in June. And meanwhile, I think all of us who are engaged in health and healthcare will continue to forge ahead with these reforms that are really aimed at improving healthcare for all Americans. And that's something that our guest today is very focused on.
Esther Dyson is a giant in the tech arena, having been an early supporter of fledgling startups like Google, LinkedIn, and Flickr. She's since turned her attention to the health arena, investing in programs that improve health, not healthcare.
So Esther has launched a new venture, and it's called Hiccup, a five-city, five-year competition to see who can incentivize improving the entire population's health. It's a big and bold idea, one of many that she's had, and she'll also be telling us about what innovations in health technologies look the most exciting to her.
Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks back at some of the more glaring misstatements about health policy made in 2014. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google Plus, and LinkedIn. We love to hear from you.
And we'll get to our interview with Esther Dyson in a moment. But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. It's 2015, and open enrollment numbers continue at a ripping pace, with over 6 million Americans either re-enrolling in a health insurance plan or enrolling for the first time via the state and federal exchanges. And millions more are being covered via expanded Medicaid coverage as well. Hospitals in states where Medicaid was expanded fared very well in the wake of the initial expansion, Now the patients who were uninsured, unable to pay for primary care, and most likely to use the emergency room for all manner of care, are now getting paid for their services. More states are seeing the wisdom of taking the federal government's 100% coverage of Medicaid expansion during the first 3 years, with several more states queuing up to do so in 2015. But there was also a provision in the health care law that expanded reimbursement for providers who treated these newly covered Medicaid patients. Traditionally, access to primary and specialist care has been a challenge for Medicaid patients, but an ACA provision added an incentive for providers to add on those patients by increasing their payment. But that provision of the law expired at the end of 2014. Providers are worried their compensation won't warrant taking on new Medicaid patients and will cut back in 2015. Community health center organizations, which have traditionally provided coverage for this population, are expected to see some increased demand and perhaps longer wait times as a result. Meanwhile, there's another consideration for Americans under the Affordable Care Act that's going to play out in accountants' offices across the country. It's the first year Americans who remain uninsured will have to pay a fine. Accounting experts are lining up for this new agenda by April 15th. And what does it take to keep the average American male happy? Results of a longitudinal 75-year study of what makes men happy and fulfilled as they age has come with some interesting findings. The results of the Harvard study, launched in 1938, looked at a variety of data points, including IQ, political orientation, religious affiliation, alcohol use, childhood experiences, even the size of genitalia, to determine predictors of happiness and a fulfilled life. Over time, the study had some compelling findings that alcohol abuse and alcoholism were the leading cause of divorce, broken families, and depression among the group. Bad childhoods could be overcome, but happy childhoods provided the best basis for long-term coping. Men were often found to find their greatest satisfaction in life and marriage after age 70, and the liberals were far more likely to be sexually active into their 80s than conservatives. You can find all the detail in Triumph of Experience on Amazon. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with entrepreneur, writer, cosmonaut, and health and tech industry angel investor Esther Dyson. She's most recently founder of Hiccup.co, a health initiative coordinating council, which has launched the Way to Wellville, a national contest designed to test new business models for improving health for participating communities while rewarding investors. Ms. Dyson earned her BA in economics from Harvard, has written extensively on the health and tech industries, including the global bestseller Release 2.0, designed for living in the digital age. Esther, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Good morning.
And you've been named one of the most influential women in the tech industry. And in recent years, you've shifted your attention to the aerospace and health industries with a particular focus on the production of health as opposed to healthcare. While new startups abound in the health space seeking to revolutionize our health systems, only a few have been successful. And you've learned so much from your deep involvement in the advent of the digital age. Can you share with our listeners lessons learned and ways that we can truly facilitate the transformation in health in this country?
Well, the first thing is to make the distinction between health and healthcare. Healthcare is necessary because a lot of people are sick or ill. But if you can invest in health up front, you both will save a huge amount of money because it's much cheaper if you intervene early. And second, because you will avoid, it's not just the cost of healthcare that are painful. It's also the fact of being ill. It's human potential. It's human suffering versus human capability. So over the years, I've started to focus more on health itself versus healthcare. And that's more difficult because it's not a question of giving people a pill. It's a question of having people eat more healthily, having them exercise, all the things we know we should do and don't. But for a lot of people, they don't even have the choice because they don't have the money. They don't have access to healthy food. The places where they live make it difficult to exercise. In a sense, society and modern conveniences erode people's attempt to live healthy lives. It's not just giving people a Fitbit and telling them, go out and exercise. It's making the good choices easier and more available and cheaper.
Well, Esther, one of the pathways, it seems to me, that you've taken to improve health or to help our society improve their healthfulness has been through angel investing. And you've logged an impressive set of winners from the early tech days like Flickr, which you sold to Yahoo, Eventful, Meetup, 23andMe, and many more. And I understand there are actually articles that circulate on the internet advising entrepreneurs on how to get their hands on Esther Dyson's money. So you've obviously made quite a reputation for yourself in that area. And you've also said that you won't invest in anything that's been done before, which certainly seems to speak to your curiosity and desire to learn. So maybe tell us specifically, what are you looking for in your decisions to back health startups? Is it the idea itself, the team, the infrastructure? What really captures your interest and imagination?
I just have to say that most of my investing was not focused on health. It is now. But there's a big difference between entrepreneurial investing in cute apps and investing in health, which is much more systemic and long-term. And what generates health is everything from any kind of employment opportunity that gives people the wherewithal to live healthy lives. But in terms of what I'm looking for as an investor, the team is the most important, because almost no matter what idea they have, it's going to change, because they're going to learn something through doing their startup, especially if they do something that hasn't been done before. They'll figure out there's probably a better way to do it. And if you have a good team, they know how to do that and change, partly because they're looking at a vision. So the ability of the team to both execute and change direction is probably key. Then obviously you want them to be doing something interesting and worthwhile. That's not as common as it should be.
You know, I wanted to get back to your thought about making good choices easier. So much of the innovations in the healthcare space really haven't addressed this issue of culture. And I want to tie that also to sort of this issue of improving health and thinking about the work of people like Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone. This is about the cultivation of social capital in communities. And so I wonder if you have some thoughts about the challenge.
Well, there's the culture of healthcare, which is persistent and very traditionally not really focused on the patient, more focused on the system itself. And there's also the short-term culture. So people don't tend to invest for the long term. If you tell someone this is going to pay off huge, but it's going to take 5 years, many of them just aren't interested. Mm-hmm. And it takes time for serious investments to pay off. And that's another cultural problem we have. It's a world of instant gratification. Mm-hmm. Retail e-commerce companies are now competing to deliver things within an hour in some large cities.
Right.
And telling someone they have to wait 5 years to see something, it's crazy. But the reality is you get sick slowly and you get healthy slowly, or you stay healthy by investing, not by renting. And in a sense, people rent their health and undermine it. And then 10 years later, they wake up and they can't run, they weigh too much, they're pre-diabetic, whatever.
Your latest venture is called HICCUP, an acronym for Health Initiative Coordinating Council, and it's based on the premise that you shouldn't have to be lucky to enjoy a normal, healthy life. And we'd love to hear about your competition that you've launched through HICCUP called The Way to Wellville, with communities across the country that have some evidence of poor overall health metrics participating in this experiment to create a new model for better health across the whole population.
It's a nonprofit, and the purpose of it is to help these communities and people around them invest long-term in health. And some of the investments will be financial, for a financial return. Some will be government spending, using social impact bonds to help the governments make that spending in a long-term way. So it's five communities that were already trying to become healthy, and we at HICCUP are helping them see their health and healthcare initiatives as something long-term, helping them to define them more as investable, sustainable projects. We're trying to get them to look at the outcomes. Okay, what happened to the level of obesity in your community? What happened to the high school graduation rate? Is the percentage of obese fifth graders going down? What's the level of transitions to diabetes in your community? So traditionally, philanthropy has been really nice, and it's been focused on what you're doing for the community. So we're bringing an investor mindset even to, if you like, public investment or philanthropy. And we believe that doing this at scale in five small places will show that it works. Because as you know, a lot of so-called health initiatives, they're really nice, but they don't have a lot of impact. If they did, we wouldn't have the health crisis we have in the country at this point.
We're speaking today with entrepreneur, writer, cosmonaut, and health industry angel investor Esther Dyson. She's most recently founder of HICCUP, the Health Initiative Coordinating Council, which has just launched a national competition, The Way to Wellville, to foster innovation and investment in community-wide health improvement. Esther, let's take a look at some of the disruptive technologies that are poised to transform health in the broad arena. We had BJ Fogg on our show, and he's a proponent of making tiny changes that can yield big improvements over time. And could you talk a little bit expound the potential of the quantified health movement and gamification as influencers in the production of health?
Okay. It's really important to make this point that just giving everybody a Fitbit will not help if they don't have access to healthy food, if they can't get to the clinic, if they can't get to work because they don't have transit. So, I mean, I love Fitbits. I love quantification. I think it's very helpful. But it's also a first world solution. Health is not simply a question of, oh, these people need more self-discipline. They need access to what the people who can afford Fitbits have easy access to. Yeah. That said, understanding what your body does, and Fitbits and the like or Jawbone are getting much cheaper and more accurate, and it gives you a better sense of what's really going on. I mean, you have a speedometer in your car. Why can't you see something equivalent for your body? And that might help you think about maintaining it better. What's interesting about gamification is that people are different, and part of the trick is going to be figuring out some people are motivated by collaboration. You know, run with your friends. You and Susie and the rest of the team can hit the goal of 10,000 miles. Other people are motivated by competition. You can beat Fred. This is Fred's numbers. Surely you can do better than that. Some people like financial incentives. Some people like status. Figuring out which of these triggers works with which individual is an important part of making this all work.
Yeah, I'd like to delve a little more deeply into this Way to Wellville quest in that context. And I think my question is about the interface between the individual focus, as we were just discussing, and where that meets up with the policy people at the community level or the government people at the community level. And I'm, you know, Mark, I'm thinking about when we had Mayor Curtatone from Somerville with us a couple of years ago at our Weizmann Symposium. And he used a couple of examples in his, you know, small but densely populated town of the kinds of investments. And the two things that really stand out to me is it doesn't cost a lot to buy some white paint and create some bike lanes in your community. Costs more to dig up asphalt and some parking lots and make them parks.
Yeah.
And but you add these things up, and on the one side, there is the policy, government people doing what they can to advance it. On the other side, I'd be really curious, in these communities, as you look at them, do you expect to see or hope to see those sort of two groups coming together, the individuals in the community and the people who have the opportunity to do some of that infrastructure work?
Yes, absolutely. This is what we're hoping to see more of. Bike lanes are great, and the built infrastructure. But in addition, the people who do their part and ride the bikes. Making change is complicated because it's, you have to train the kitchen workers. You know, as a kitchen worker, I'd much rather be serving children food that I knew was good. But you also have to change the equipment. You have to renegotiate with your suppliers. You may have some 5-year contract. So it's basically, the whole point is exactly what you said. It doesn't cost a lot, but it takes a lot of effort to make the change, to renegotiate contracts, to get the political buy-in, because when you paint the bike lanes, some of the car people are going to object. So you need a community-wide effort, and you need complementary things. You change the food in the schools. Now you also want the vending machines at the Y to change, local grocery store to start selling vegetables so that the kids who may learn how to cook at school can come home and their parents can buy the same vegetables so that they can. It's a combination of the community leadership, some of the people, you know, let's face it, they're not going to be interested, but if you change what's happening around them, they may get just dragged along. And as you know, bad health is contagious, so is good health. So even the people you don't reach directly are going to be living in a different environment that's going to make it easier.
Thinking about your statement of bad health is contagious, I was sort of reflecting on Christakis up at Harvard, who is mapping out, a social scientist, diabetes, obesity, and sort of looking at sort of the contagion that sort of exists in networks and thinking about networks, because you've been thinking about things in this next larger context. It's not the Fitbit, it's the sort of system around that. I wonder if we go one more context outside of it, and it's really about the social network that you're in. And I wonder how you can be disruptive in that, because everything else is kind of interesting, but it turns out to be that if I don't have any friends who have this behavior, I may not be influenceable. And I usually cultural change is about how my peers and others, my larger network, relate to these set of issues. And that may be above all of our pay grades in terms of initiatives. And we work with, you know, special populations, so 130,000 people, they're all 200% of poverty and below. But we spend a lot of time on thinking about ways to cultivate healthy social networks for people, in addition to making sure the infrastructure is in place.
Yeah. You know, in the end, you can't barge in on people and change their lives, but if you can get some people in a social network, they will influence the others. There's no magic. You have to try and try until you reach some kind of tipping point. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But clearly, again, if you change what's going on at the Y, some people will be influenced and they will influence others. You have to start somewhere, and you never know where the best place is to start. But if you attract some people, they will help you attract more. And the laggards may eventually finally get caught up. Meetup is an example, actually, of a for-profit investment that's very key in this building this social infrastructure and helping people to do everything from running together to just the kind of social fellowship that Bob Putnam was talking about, simply mm-hmm. being with other people and having friends statistically leads to better health or to less bad health. People are social animals, and being isolated and alone is probably the worst thing you can do for your health.
Esther, we have often asked this question of our guests, but it's been a while since we have, and I think you are a great person, and this is a good opportunity to get your perspective. Considering all of the eyes that you have out there on the leading edge of what is going on, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see as the real possible breakthroughs in health that our listeners at Conversations should be keeping an eye on?
Probably the biggest breakthrough technologically that's coming is going to be non-invasive blood analysis, biomarker detection, you know, real-time glucose monitoring that doesn't require you to prick your fingers. So whether it's Google's contact lenses or Theranos, there's a bunch of these. And again, the ability to see in real time the impact of your behavior, whether it's I went for a run and it was good for my blood sugar, or I ate a donut and, oh my God, disaster. That both helps you manage and it helps you understand what you're doing. So for everything from detecting cancer, I mean, there's a lot of different things you can detect in people's blood. Everything from knowing, gee, you know, maybe I should get a colon cancer screening, to my blood sugar is persistently a little higher than it should be. That's probably the biggest technological thing that's coming down the pike right now. Yeah, there will be this drug and that drug for this disease mm-hmm. or that disease,
right.
But for overall broad-based health, it's going to be simply much better analysis of biomarkers.
We've been speaking today with Esther Dyson, entrepreneur, angel investor, and founder of many companies, including Hiccup. .co. You can learn more about that by going to hiccup.co or follow her on Twitter at edyson. Esther, thank you so much for joining us in Conversations on Healthcare Today.
Thank you very much. And we're in the middle of a happy new year, and I hope everybody remembers their New Year's resolutions and continues to follow them.
That is right.
Absolutely. Sweet.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Let's take a look back at some of the whoppers of 2014 on healthcare. In the midterm elections, we saw plenty of ads designed to scare seniors about Medicare. Democratic ads claimed Republicans would end the Medicare guarantee, a misleading reference to the candidate's support for Representative Paul Ryan's Medicare plan. Ryan's plan wouldn't end the guarantee of Medicare or Medicare benefits, as these ads claimed. Instead, it proposed phasing in a government subsidy program in which future beneficiaries picked from traditional Medicare or private insurance plans, which must offer the same benefits as traditional Medicare. Republicans, meanwhile, continued to push the old misleading claim that the Affordable Care Act would cut Medicare by $716 billion. That's a reduction in the future growth of spending over 10 years, not a slashing of the current budget. There were also many claims about premiums skyrocketing under the ACA. In fact, employer-sponsored premiums, where most Americans have coverage, have been growing at historically low rates in the past few years. President Obama, meanwhile, continued to tout the historically low rate of growth of healthcare spending. It's true that total healthcare expenditures since 2009 have grown at the lowest rates since the data was first compiled in 1960. But Obama implies that the ACA caused that slow growth, and experts say while the law may have had some impact, the growth rates are mainly due to the slow economy. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. At one point in the early 2000s, Oklahoma City was one of the most obese cities in the nation, a fact that was not lost on the city's mayor, Mick Cornett, who, to his own chagrin, learned that he was in that group.
I finally decided I needed to lose weight, and I knew I could because I'd done it so many times before, so I simply stopped eating as much. I had been eating 3,000 calories a day. And I cut it to 2,000 calories a day, and the weight came off. I lost about a pound a week for about 40 weeks.
A decision to lose weight led him to examine what was causing the high obesity rates of his city's residents. And he learned that development since the 1970s had removed much of the city's walkability in favor of cars.
We had built an incredible quality of life if you happened to be a car. But if you happened to be a person, you are combating the car seemingly at every turn.
He took two approaches to the problem. He launched the OKC Million program, inviting Oklahoma City residents to an ambitious weight loss challenge to lose a collective million pounds.
I decided that the first thing we needed to do was have a conversation. You see, in Oklahoma City, we weren't talking about obesity. And so on New Year's Eve of 2007, I went to the zoo and I stood in front of the elephants and I said, "This city is going on a diet, and we're going to lose a million pounds."
In addition to that challenge, he urged city planners and developers to improve the city's walkability, first around the city's dozens of school zones, and then throughout the entire city.
We added a new Central Park, 70 acres in size, to be right downtown in Oklahoma City. We're building a downtown streetcar to try and help the walkability formula. We're building senior health and wellness centers. We put some investments on the river, and now we are currently in the final stages of developing the finest venue in the world for the sports of canoe, kayak, and rowing, along with inner city programs to get kids more engaged in these types of recreational activities that are a little bit non-traditional. We also are building hundreds of miles of new sidewalks.
Since he issued his challenge, a million pounds have been lost, and participants have walked or run a collective 1.2 million miles. The average participant lost about 12 pounds. But when you factor the tens of thousands who participated, what a significant public health improvement in a relatively short period of time. The OKC Million program, where a city leader took an entire population on a weight loss challenge, improving the infrastructure, providing leadership and incentives to facilitate that challenge, and ultimately improving the health and impacting the obesity epidemic throughout the city's population in the process. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.